Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
All right, 226 American. Years ago today, what monumental document was signed? It was the Constitution of the United States. And today, of all days, we are going to have a rocking show. Welcome to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie, along with my intellectual and also politically active co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Well, good afternoon. What was the name of that document again? I've never heard of that. Neither has our president, the last I checked. But good afternoon, Annie, and everyone.
Yeah, and it is amazing because we will be talking about Second Amendment rights today. And did you hear there's a school district out of Texas, I believe it's called Denton is the name of the town. They've rewritten the history book and rephrased the Bill of Rights. Do you know that according to this history book, I don't have it in front of me, but I was listening to Glenn Beck as he was reading these inserts in the book, and the Second Amendment is you have the right to bear arms if you're in a militia.
I didn't know exactly that wording, but yes, I mean, I know that they've,
paraphrased the Bill of Rights to twist it to their progressive illogic. But I'm going to see if I can find some way to get a copy of that history book. It should be very interesting to read and to dissect. But anyway, we've got ourselves a great show going. We've got two guests coming up back-to-back. Gunnery Sergeant, Marine Corps retired Jesse Jane Duff, who's a strong advocate for veterans' rights and gun rights. And then we have Talbot Black Jr., and he's got his fingers in quite a few things here. One is gun rights, and one is the Palmetto Initiative, where we look to keep our government limited. So they will be joining us at about quarter after the hour and at 2:45. But in the interim...
Before we get rocking, just a quick message before... I'm not at the computer, so you got to play the music. Is that Maryland has... they actually have started a petition drive to secede from the U.S. So that is a breaking story. So you might want to talk about that towards the end of the hour.
Okay. Also, this occurred last night around 9:30, 10 o'clock last night. Fairfield County Republican Party, the Fairfield County GOP here in the great state of South Carolina, passed a petition to censor Lindsey Graham. How's that? We've got now two counties out of 46 that within the last 30 days have put forth a censure and had it succeed to pass. And there is an initiative going up on Facebook. People can find it. South Carolina Citizens for the Censure of Lindsey Graham. There's a petition up there and a link. Or if you simply Google South Carolina Citizens for the Censure of Lindsey Graham, you will find the Go petition up there. It went up only 5 days ago, and when I last looked at it, there were 62 signatures on it, and it's just starting to make it around the social networks. So we'll
see.
What
is that?
The petition?
Yeah.
All right, let me see if I can pull it up, because actually I should be able to pull it up, because I'm the one guilty of it. So, let me see if I can pull up the South Carolina... Citizens, I'm sorry, I don't type that fast.
Oh, well.
I'm going to see if I can put it up in the chat room. Here we go. I got it. And let me open up this link. And this little stupid thing's in the way. And come on, pull up the petition. Oh, here it is. Here's the petition. And as of now, I said 62. So within the last half hour, two more people signed. There are now 64 people on this petition. If anyone, it's up in the chat room. It's at gopetition.com, and it's called South Carolina Citizens in Support of Censure of Lindsey Graham. You can pass this on to anyone within the state of South Carolina that's eligible to sign. So if you know anyone in South Carolina, go to this link at GoPetition and send the petition around. Let's make it viral. That's really scary.
To censor
Jesus,
him, what means what?
It means that the Republican Party disagrees with all of his actions. And at that point, you know, you have enough people censuring you, you're trying to run for re-election. It's like, bye-bye.
Well, good. So, let's hope we can make that happen.
Yep. Absolutely. And we're going to get Lee Bright to come back on the show. Anyone that listens to the show knows that we do a dedication to a fallen hero. And this dedication was requested by Gunnery Sergeant Jesse Jane Duff specifically. So we will do this dedication. And this goes out to USMC Corporal Jason L. Dunham. He died April 22, 2004, and was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously. He died 8 days after he deliberately covered a grenade to save nearby Marines, which were on patrol in Iraq. And part of this is from the Wall Street Journal. Part of it is from an honor page. Corporal Jason Dunham and two other Marines sat in an outpost in Iraq and traded theories on surviving a hand grenade attack. Second Lieutenant Brian Bull Robinson suggested that if a Marine lay face down on the grenade and held it between his forearms, the ceramic bulletproof plate in his flak vest might be strong enough to protect his vital organs. His arms would shatter, but he might live. Corporal Dunham had another idea. A Marine's Kevlar helmet held over the grenade might contain the blast. I'll bet a Kevlar would stop it, he said, according to Second Lieutenant Robinson. No, it'll mess you up, Staff Sergeant John Ferguson recalls saying. It was a conversation the men would remember vividly a few weeks later when they saw the shredded remains of Corporal Dunham's helmet, apparently blown apart from the inside by a grenade. Fellow Marines believe Corporal Dunham's actions saved the lives of two men and have recommended him for the Medal of Honor. He was awarded in 2007 at the White House by George W. Bush. The 6'1" star high school athlete from Saho, New York, Corporal Dunham was chosen to become a squad leader shortly after he was assigned to Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment in September of 2003. just 22 years old, he showed the kind of leadership where you're confident in your abilities and don't have to yell about it, said Staff Sergeant Ferguson of Aurora, Colorado. Corporal Dunham's reputation grew when he extended his enlistment, due to end in July, so he could stay with his squad throughout its tour in the war zone. April 14, 2004, was an especially bad day. Corporal Dunham was in the town of Kerbala, leading a 14-man patrol to scout sites for a new base, when radio reports came pouring in about a roadside bomb hitting another group of Marines not far away. Insurgents, the report said, had ambushed a convoy that included the battalion commander, 40-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Lopez of Chicago. One rifle shot penetrated the rear of Commander's Humvee, hitting him in the back. Lieutenant Colonel Lopez says his translator and bodyguard, Lance Corporal Ahem Fala, had taken a bullet to the bicep, severing an artery, according to medical reports. Corporal Dunham's patrol jumped aboard some Humvees and raced towards the convoy. Near the double arch gateway of the town of Hezbollah, they heard the distinctive whizzing sounds of a rocket propelled grenade overhead. They left their vehicles and split into two teams to hunt for the shooters. Around 2:15 p.m., Dunham's team came to an intersection and saw a line of seven Iraqi vehicles along a dirt alleyway. At Staff Sergeant Ferguson's instructions, they started checking the vehicles for weapons. Corporal Dunham approached a rundown white Toyota Land Cruiser. The driver, an Iraqi in a black tracksuit and loafers, immediately lunged out and grabbed the corporal by the throat, according to the men at the scene. Corporal Dunham kneed the man in the chest, and the two tumbled to the ground. Two other Marines rushed to the scene. Private First Class Kelly Miller, 21, of Eureka, California, ran from the passenger side of the vehicle and put a chokehold around the man's neck. But the Iraqi continued to struggle, according to a military report Private First Class Miller later gave. Lance Corporal William B. Hampton of Woodinville, Washington, also ran up to help. A few yards away, Lance Corporal Jason Sanders, a radio operator from McAllister, Oklahoma, said he heard Corporal Dunham yell a warning, "No, no, no, watch his hand." What was in the Iraqi's hand appears to have been a British-made Mills bomb hand grenade. The Marines later found an unexploded Mills bomb in the Toyota along with an AK-47 assault rifles and rocket-propelled grenade launchers. A Mills bomb user pulls a ring pin out and squeezes the external lever called the spoon until he's ready to throw it. Then he releases the spoon, leaving the bomb armed. Typically 3 to 5 seconds elapse between the time the spoon detaches and the grenade explodes. The Marines later found what they believed to have been the grenade's pin on the floor of the Toyota, suggesting that the Iraqi had the grenade in his hand on a hair trigger, even as he wrestled with Corporal Dunham. None of the other Marines saw exactly what Corporal Dunham did, or even saw the grenade, but they believed Corporal Dunham spotted the grenade, prompting his warning cry, and when it rolled loose, placed his helmet and body on top of it to protect his squad mates. At 4:43 p.m. on April 22, 2004, Marine Corporal Jason L. Dunham died. 6 days later, 3rd Battalion gathered in the parking lot outside of the Al-Qayyim command post for psalms and ceremony. In a traditional combat memorial, one Marine plunged a rifle, bayonet first, into a sandbag and placed a pair of tan combat boots in front, and a third perched a helmet on the rifle stock. Lance Corporal Dean told those assembled about a trip to Las Vegas the two men and Becky Jo Dean had taken in January, not long before the battalion left for the Persian Gulf. Chatting in a hotel room, the corporal told his friends he was planning to extend his enlistment and stay in Iraq for the battalion's entire tour. "You're crazy for extending," Lance Corporal Dean recalled saying. "Why?" He says, Corporal Dunham responded, "I want to make sure everyone comes home alive. I want to be sure you go home to your wife alive." Jason L. Dunham was 22 years old when he left us. He came from a small town, Asiho, population of 1,900. It's the kind of town where everyone knows your name, where values and respect still mean something. It was here, along a winding country road filled with rolling meadows and a swift-moving creek, that Jason L. Dunham was brought into this world. He was born November 10th, the Marine Corps birthday, 1981. As you turn into the Dunham's long driveway that leads to their house, the breeze catches a yellow ribbon tied to the mailbox, and the story begins to unfold. The further you drive, two flags adorn the front porch, an American flag and the United States Marine Corps flag. They both seem to play the same quiet song, and yet both stand tall for this fallen young man. There is a final reminder that Jason Dunham is no longer with us. A blue star on the front window has been replaced by a gold star, symbolizing the Dunham family loss. To Corporal Dunham, to all men and women who serve, have served, and are serving, we dedicate this song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herndon. God bless them all.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. My name is America. I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger. And I'll rise. I stand for my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud. I rise up from the flames, and I'll always
Todd Allen Herndon, My Name is America. And Mike, we've got our guest here on hold. I'm going to bring her on live in a second. But that was, I would say, one of the hardest dedications I did. That was a tough one.
These dedications of all our shows are dedicated to the fallen heroes. And it's not, we do it because it is hard. I mean, they sacrifice their lives. And when that knock comes on the door, it shatters another life of many. And that's why we do it. And I know it was tough for you, Annie. I could hear it in your voice. But, I mean, as always, our show is dedicated to those who have fallen and given us the freedoms we preserve. Good job. Now, as they say, in show business, the show must go on.
We've got to say good job to Corporal Dunham, and our prayers are with his family. It never gets easy, and even as the years go by, you know, you always turn around and look over your shoulder looking for that loved one.
As we did last dedication and as we did now, here's a person who jumps on a grenade to save others. I mean, just that just speaks volumes for everything about the United States Service, men and women. That just says everything.
All right. With that said, let's bring on one tough Marine who spent 20 years in the Marine Corps, retired as a gunnery sergeant, same rank as my ex-husband. And I want to welcome aboard Jessie Jane Duff. Good afternoon, Semper Fi Jessie. I can say it because I was Marine by injection.
Yes. No, that's fun. I love hearing Semper Fi. It means always faithful, Semper Fidelis. So it's wonderful to hear that. Thank you for having me.
Yes. And you know, I think back when I did the dedication, I'm thinking, what was I doing exactly on November 10th, 1981? And I know exactly where I was. I was at the Marine Corps Ball with my ex-husband, and it was in Garden City, New York. And that was when Raymond Kelly was the commanding officer of 1st MARDIV.
That's fascinating. That's why I picked him to be dedicated, because he was born on the Marine Corps birthday, and he's only one of two Marines that have been awarded the Medal of Honor. We happen to also have one that is still living. Everybody has probably heard of Dakota Meyer, who has probably done something as heroically, but most Medal of Honor recipients are deceased, because what they do is sacrifice their life to save others.
Yeah, and Dakota Meyer was recently on. He was talking about Syria, and God bless his heart. I mean, he's out there still fighting the fight, even though he's no longer active in the Marine Corps. But that man has one big pair on him.
I expect that he would still be out there. He's the youngest Medal of Honor recipient that has received it, one. Two, receiving the Medal of Honor and to be alive, he's going to be in high demand to speak to audiences. So I wouldn't expect for him to become a recluse. He's got a future in front of him where he can benefit all of the military. He is basically now someone who is an advocate for veterans, and that's expected of him from the standing that here he's a Medal of Honor recipient. It's such an honor to be awarded that.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It certainly is. Jessie, before we get going with the show, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, like where you grew up, where you were raised, and what led you into being one of the awesome heroes of our military?
Well, I grew up in California, primarily Sacramento, California, and after high school, actually a little bit before the end of high school, I was realizing my parents and I didn't get along so well, and I came from a family that was very hardworking, and I had a lot of focus and drive within me, so I moved out very young, and I started working, and then I started thinking to myself, I've picked kind of a go-nowhere fast track if I don't get serious. I was smart enough to see that. And I thought, well, what can I do to show my family that I got it? And I checked out the Air Force, and I thought, okay, this just doesn't seem tough enough for me. And then I looked at the Navy and went by the Marine Corps office not expecting to join it. I had actually walked by. I was 17 years old, mind you, and a friend of mine was in there who had graduated high school with me. So I walked in, the recruiter jumps up and goes, why don't you join the Marines? And I looked at him, I said, but you don't have anything for women. He said, yes, we do. And literally at that moment, I said, oh, then this is the one I want. I knew that had the most dynamic, difficult name behind it. And if I earned that title, my parents would say, well, I guess she's okay. So I chose it for a very, very unusual reason. It wasn't a family history. I was probably the least likely to join the Marines. I studied ballet, piano, tap, jazz. I was on stage since I was 3 years old. Going into the Marine Corps didn't fit where people would have thought I was going. But those skills I had to have a lot of determination, drive, and tenacity, and those are the core elements of a successful Marine. So I did the 4 years, and next thing you know, I was reenlisting. Next thing you know, I was doing 20 years. I was made a tractor-trailer driver. I didn't even have a driver's license when I drove. So that's another story within itself. But I hauled for the infantry wing units all over California during Desert Storm, pulled their gear out of the desert, hauled onto their ships, did some very hard, tough labor. I had no fear of that, but also became an operations chief for motor transport. I also was an equal opportunity advisor, which my mother laughed at. She says the Marines have equal opportunity advisors. Like, what's equal about this? And there is some humor in that because Marines are tough as nails, but we do ensure that our Marines are treated fairly and with dignity and respect. And I had also served as a recruiter in Phoenix, Arizona, briefly. So that's a 20-year career in a nutshell. When people say, well, where'd you go? I'm looking at them thinking, oh, I can't even begin this conversation. I moved 9 times in 20 years and various overseas tours. So that's it in a nutshell right there.
All right. Now, you went through the stumps, not through Paris Island?
Yes, all the women in the Marines go through Paris Island, South Carolina. The men west of the Mississippi go to San Diego, and those east of the Mississippi go to Paris Island, South Carolina also. We have only one battalion of females that in the entire Corps. There's 3 battalions of men at each location. The females in the Marines are less than 6% of the entire Marine Corps, and out of the ranks I was in, I was a gunnery sergeant between the E-7s and E-9s. There's less than maybe 2%. Of that rank. So you're talking a tiny, tiny population of women, let alone those that decide to retire out of the Marines. Many of them have many that have retired do not come out of a motor transport background because it is dynamically probably not what you would expect females to be in, and many have a harder time adjusting. I can't tell you how I did without going into another radio segment, but I did. It is exactly what you picture. It is hard, and you learn to adjust, and I can understand many women saying, okay, I've had enough of this. It's a push, 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 and those who want to see women in the infantry, which is an entirely different topic, also, I'm doubly bowled over. I'm like, you obviously have never served with the infantry because their bodies will depreciate at a much higher rate than those of the men without the muscle mass, without the lung capacity. It's not about if you can do it. You got to look at the longevity. It is hard. And they eat their young, basically. They're not around there to baby anybody. So it's a great organization. It does what it's supposed to do. But if you're faint at heart, it may not be the right path for someone else to take.
Yeah,
so
matter of fact,
just always like a stud, because obviously, being polite, you sure are not ugly. So, and then you mentioned you had danced and you were on stage. So, I mean, were you just a beautiful tough one, or a princess who had to get molded, or because obviously you've emphasized it's hard.
Yep. Yeah, being of, I think I give great credit to several things. One, I grew up with a very disciplined family. That's why I moved out. Wasn't adjusting to them very well. but I did adjust to them. I had standards where I understood what discipline was. I just at 17 wanted to pave my own path. We all know how that goes. You'll listen to your teachers or your counselors, but you're not listening to your parents. It was that kind of thing. So I was used to discipline. My parents were very strict, and my father's a World War II vet. I was the last of 5 kids. So I had a kind of a generation gap there. He was not conducive to modern age behavior of young women. I didn't even get to date. But that tough environment did teach me a lot, too. I was a ballet dancer, and I was in a class for either tap, jazz, or ballet maybe 3-4 days a week. And I studied the piano. So the great discipline, attention to detail, learning to take constructive criticism, all of those things, when I got in boot camp, it was actually surprisingly easy for me to adjust. I got it. I got it immediately. It's a lot like athletes who have a coach screaming all the time. I had ballet instructors that would knock your leg if you weren't holding it correctly and scream at you if you forgot the steps and they knew you didn't practice. So I adjusted. I was never a princess, although I looked like one, and I was teased quite a bit. The drill instructor said, "What do you think you are, Miss America?" And then that was just embarrassing to me, but I was not having a hard time with that discipline. Women who grow up without discipline, men who grow up without discipline, the military cannot change you. It has to be inherently within you to want to change yourself. If you don't want somebody to, I hear people say, I can't go in the military, I don't want anybody telling me what to do, and I'm thinking, well, you can't go anywhere in life with that mindset. So, you know, the Marines was not impossible for me by any means, obviously.
No, it's funny because, you know, some of the things that you relate, you say, I can relate to, because my father was a World War II veteran also, and our family was very, very structured. And for me, my music was either vocal or classical violin. And you know, playing classical music, you have to go at it hour after hour and after hour. And yeah, if you mess up, next thing you know, there's a rap on your hand. It's like, you didn't practice this music. You were not paying attention. You didn't hear what I was saying. And it's like, oh, and all of a sudden you start shrinking. But you've got to have the backbone to say, all right, fine,
yeah,
I screwed up. Let's go forward and let's try this
yeah.
again and again.
Very good.
Again.
Yeah. Very good example. I played the violin also. Very, very good discipline. And that example is true. You learn to take criticism that kind of hurts your feelings early. So you do grasp that it's meant to better you and nobody needs to baby you. So it is something that I was able to adjust to.
Yeah. And
okay,
funny
you
now
did
that
drama,
I live,
you danced, you played the piano, she played the violin, she's a Marine. You ever been a congresswoman or a state senator?
You know, I'm on Twitter and I've got people all the time saying you need to run for office, and I keep telling them no. I have no interest in going into the very thing that I'm constantly criticizing. I feel like once you're in that, you're smothered with a lot of expectations from groups that you may not be able to help. I think it's very hard to stand on your convictions and win elections. People have to waffle often. I'd rather be the one on the outside saying, this is what we need to do to improve it, and what are you going to do to change it? And it's very easy and glamorous to say, oh, I want to be a senator and I want to be a congressman. But you really have to have the desire to go on a campaign trail, have your entire life turned upside down. And I think there's a little level of narcissism in it with the politicians I've met. And I just don't want to become that kind of a person where I become a little bit plastic like that.
You sound exactly like me. And I have absolutely no political ambitions. I like my avocation. I do either here on the show or actively through our Tea Party. Right now, we've got a petition here in South Carolina to right now it's up there in our chat room, South Carolina Citizens in Support of Censure of Lindsey Graham. We've got two GOP counties that have already censured him out of 46. So we've got 44 more to go, and I'm going to be advocating for ours here in Beaufort. And you know Beaufort County very well, because I just passed Paris Island Gateway this morning, taking my husband to the eye doctor. So I'm not right in the heart of the Tri-Command, and you can't get any more red state than here. So we're going to see what we can
do. Oh, I'm sure.
And now, Jesse, you have a couple of things that you really work very hard on, and one is veteran issues. And you recently wrote an article, Broken Promises, about the bonuses going to VA employees, whereas veterans are waiting years and years and years for benefits. And then recently there was a news report, and I think this was up on Fox, I could be right or wrong, where they showed that the VA is not even computerized. These claims are just sitting on tables and in cabinets to the point where the offices' floors are starting to buckle from the weight of the paperwork. But you go and pay these employees the benefits and salaries and bonuses, but you just ignore the paperwork?
That's
you know,
horrible. Go ahead, I'll let you comment, Betsy, but that's horrible. Go ahead.
The VA administration, which really surprises me right now, they know they're being criticized. I don't know if anybody's seen this ad. It's a full ad running on television right now with this young woman who apparently had a career in the Navy discussing about how she's getting benefits from the VA now that she served. Her father did, and her parents got a VA loan. And it's pump, pump, pump. Look at us. Look at us. Look at what we're doing for our veterans. And it's a beautifully run ad, but it's leaving out some of the critical faux pas that they have going on right now, like the close to 500,000 veteran backlog. It's not, it just dropped below 500,000 within the past few weeks. These are people that have not received their medical benefits, have not even had their claims looked at. I mean, just to get it looked at, it's still under 125 days. Many of these claims on average are taking over 276 days. So you could have somebody who has critical issues with maybe various healthcare problems such as knees, joints. Anybody who was discharged with a missing limb was already granted probably medical retirement, which is different state. But people who have gotten out and have claims that say, look, I was in this type of environment, you've got your PTSD, young men and women, you've got a lot of different issues out there, and they haven't been addressed. So we've read reports that have said as high as 20,000 veterans a year are dying waiting on their medical benefits. Many of these veterans are not your Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans. They are your Vietnam era, your Desert Storm era, because the VA recently opened up the gates for Agent Orange to be considered, and it wasn't being considered before. And it opened up for PTSD, which wasn't being considered before, which is shocking, and Desert Storm Syndrome, which is something that has, I haven't done a lot of research on, but people have heard that some of the chemicals they inhaled while they were over there, they've had dramatic medical problems since then. Fast forward, these men, some of them in their 60s and 70s, have not had their claims addressed, and that's why there is a fatality rate associated with this. They opened up the floodgates back in, I believe it was 2009. Secretary Shinsky wanted to honor Agent Orange, for example, which is great, but he put no plan in effect for all of the veterans out there that were going to submit claims. So the flood of claims comes in, and they're ill-prepared for it. 97% of their process was still being done manually. So here we've got a manual system with an overload of claims coming in, and they failed to address it. It got so out of control all the way up to this early this year, they expected to hit a million veteran backlogs in claims. And we started going after it at Concerned Veterans for America. That's where I'm an advocate, concernedveteransforamerica.org. This is our biggest issue, is the claims that are not being addressed by the VA. So we started chasing them down, doing massive publicity campaigns, and they started hiring extra people and giving people overtime, 20 hours a week overtime, which is ridiculous also. But get this, it's not a money issue. The VA has the second largest budget next to DOD, plus Congress awarded them $25 billion additional dollars over the last 4 years. So we're sitting here pouring money into a system that's inefficient. Why haven't they hired somebody who can mainstream their systems, get in there, run it like a corporation, and stop giving bonuses to executives who have failed to produce results? It's broken. We're addressing it. We're attacking it. And we're hoping to save the lives of more veterans, because they don't expect the backlog to be resolved till 2015.
Yeah, it's so true what you're saying, because I think back to a friend of ours that we lost because of Agent Orange, and a bunch of us were fighting, and we had a congressman out there, and he was slowly dying of liver failure and cancer, and the more we tried to fight for his benefits, the more roadblocks I got thrown up. And there must have been a core group of us, and it just, we could not beat the clock. And I think of now, even with my father, him having to go to the VA hospital for any treatments and stuff, and he has to wait weeks, sometimes months. And God bless his soul, he's going to be 86 next month. How much longer are we going to have to wait to help treat him? And
we're suspicious that they're going to be pushing claims through so quickly that they may not even be giving them an accurate rating. Now, there is some evidence of this, but not hard evidence. So this is just a thought that is going on, that we're going to be seeing vets getting 10% in disability versus, maybe the 35 or 40 that they rate, just to get them out of the backlog, knowing they'll come back with an appeal, which is another backlog in itself, the appeal site. But see, they're breaking down the numbers so that one hand doesn't look as bad unless you combine both hands. So there are many people that have gotten through the claims process who are now in the appeals process. We're not even talking about those numbers, which are close to 250,000.
Yeah, when you were saying that, I was just imagining how they were juggling the numbers. We know how this administration and all previous administrations love to fudge the numbers. So they'll say, okay, all right, 2 million claims came in, but we processed three-quarters
right.
of them.
Out
of that three-quarters that you processed, how many resulted in appeal? So if they don't tell that fluctuating number, that little tiny telltale,
Exactly.
I'm trying to think of the right word. But
yeah, it's not accountable. It's not accountable, and it's misleading. And this is one thing that I've noticed with administrations, multiple of them, that government waste is inherent. And I don't even think one president could ever clean it all out. It is a mindset. It is a lifestyle. It's a way that has run, and it has not been managed effectively and efficiently, where you get rid of your bottom 10% like you would see in any Fortune 50 company. It's not aggressive about that. It's more of a job security situation. I'm not dogging out every government employee, by no means, but I guarantee any government employee listening to the show knows someone of their coworkers who does not carry their weight and wishes that they could have been released or fired. You know, it is not like the corporate world where it is a much more demanding process for accountability on a regular basis, or you're not going to see your next paycheck. So not to degrade those who work very hard supporting, and there's many VA employees out there who are actually going through periods of depression now because it's so overwhelming, and they've even made comments to the press that they're being pushed to push harder. Some of them have even said, I don't know how fair these claims are going to be now since we are being aggressively pushed to get them knocked out through the system.
Yeah, and there's something
That's
else you said, truth. But there's another truth that you said about government employees. And when I had married my husband, that was back in my first one, the gunnery sergeant, back in 1980, at one point they were trying to get me to work up in First Mar Div. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, fine, you get yourself a nice cushy job, you get yourself a what's my incentive to do better? And I started talking to these people that were working up there, and they said, oh, no, you get assigned a GAO number. And I said, all right, fine, but what if I want to learn another job and move up the scale? Oh, you can't do that. Why not? Where's the incentive to do better, to perform better, to make whatever your job is more efficient? And every time I asked these questions, it was like, no, there isn't. You have only this, and this is what you do. So if your job is just counting paper clips, that's all you do. And I says, I can't live that way. I'd rather stay in the private sector and, you know, pull myself up by my bootstraps. But this is the mindset of our government employees. And under this administration, the number of these government employees has grown to a record level.
It is upsetting. You know, but the thing is that we as the voters allow this to happen. We allowed it to happen, not just once, but twice. And I don't know what these solutions are. I've got contacts on both sides of the conservative element. I've got the very far right. I've got the middle ground. I've even got a few rhinos that still do maintain conservative principles on many levels. The bottom line is that we're not agreeing on anything, and we're losing a lot of what our focus is. And maybe the Tea Party was probably one of the best things to happen because it's saying, look, tax enough already. Let's stick with what we know. Less government, more efficiency, strong defense, and make people independent as to how they're going to acquire their type of lifestyle and freedom of choice versus the government handouts and whatnot. But it's just not government handouts. We've done brokerings with major corporations that allow a lot of tax breaks and things that prevent a lot of fairness when it comes to taxation. So there's a lot of issues there. We can't just say the corporations are scot-free and it's only the people on welfare that are causing problems, because corporate welfare and our crony capitalism is rampant. You know, I shake your hand, you shake my hand, boom, I've got the deal, the bill goes through, and now one of the defense contractors has millions of dollars getting plugged down the toilet for something that will never, ever get produced. So it goes on at very high levels with people driving nice cars, nice suits, who know that they're squeezing the government for every bit of dollar they can get, and they're not necessarily doing the best thing in the taxpayer's interest. And we've got the waste with those that are abusing fairly a lot of entitlement programs. And often the media is chasing, conservative media is chasing after these people abusing entitlement programs, but they're not abusing those that are milking the government. The highest rate of median income in the nation is in the Washington, D.C. area, $89,000 a year, right in this area. And where's all that money coming from? Government and government contracts and government contractors.
Actually, the taxpayer.
So, well, exactly, and that is the taxpayer. So, you know, the guy throwing stones who's working as a contractor, milking everything he can, is not necessarily looking in the mirror and saying, am I providing the most effective service? Now, I'm not dogging out the contractors because, again, that is not what I'm trying to – I don't want the message to get lost. What I'm getting at is there is waste and abuse on so many levels. Concerned Veterans for America wants to see an audit of particular areas of the Defense Department. Let's see what areas we can streamline and get rid of some of these programs that have been endlessly on the shelf for various defense systems and have gone nowhere, money going down a drain, and then we can ensure that our forces are ready to deploy and we have a force that is efficient and effective. It goes in many, many directions. And to be a conservative, you have to remember, you know, if you let some of those other topics distract you, guess what? We'll keep losing elections. You know, stick with what you want. You want the government out of your life, then remember that's your reason you're going to get somebody into office, not start getting caught up in sidebar issues that are really moral issues that deal with the family, that deal with how you raise your children. But if you're going to regulate it with the government, then you're going right back into the government hands again. So, you know, many people may dispute me. I've had people argue with me over certain social issue objectives. And I say, well, that may not be why, if that's your issue, that's great, but I'm not going to be a single issue voter. I know what being a conservative is.
Absolutely. Now, Jesse, I want you to hold on because I'm going to bring in Talbot, teeth in backwards, Talbot Blatt with the Palmetto Gun Rights and Palmetto Liberty Pack, because everything he's doing is exactly up the same alley that you are for limited government, for Second Amendment rights. So welcome aboard, Talbot Blatt. You're with us with Gunnery Sergeant Jesse Duff, retired USMC, and my co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Oh, it's great to be on. And as I was listening to the conversation before you brought me in, I was thinking, right, wow, Jesse is right on target. I agree 100% with everything she's saying and just enjoying listening. Thank you.
I'll tell you, well, just what you talked about with the veterans and just how we are ignoring our, especially those who need care. That is just unconscionable. I mean, I am ashamed of my own country that we can do this to these people, some of them who joined the service at such a young age. And I don't know what to say. I'll pass it back to you.
Well, you know, there's also Talbot and Jesse that they were trying at one point to cut back the benefits on military families and veterans by making them pay for their own health insurance. It's like, all right, fine, we're sending you out to the front line to either get maimed or killed, but in the interim, you've got to cover your own doctor bills should you get injured. I don't understand the government thinking except for the fact it is a massive power grab and it's a narcissistic tendency by these people up in D.C. that just don't want to face the reality of life. I don't even know how else to explain it. Why don't you take that, Jesse? Did we lose Jesse?
No, you did not lose me, but unfortunately I had put my phone on mute because I was near a construction zone. because I couldn't hear you in the construction zone hit, go ahead and either rephrase the question or let Tal take it so that I can hear what you were saying. I'm sorry.
Well, I was saying that the wasteful government spending to the point where now that they wanted to limit the benefits that military families and veterans got by making them pay for their own health insurance. You know, you're being sent to the front line, but you have to pay for your own doctor should you get injured.
Well, I've what's going on right now, see, I'm retired and I do pay for my own health insurance, but I am at a very good, a very reasonable and affordable rate because I'm a retired Marine. Now, if you are coming through the Veterans Administration and you actually have been diagnosed with a percentage, let's say you're 30% disabled. Now, keep in mind the word disabled does not mean you're in a walker, you're in a wheelchair. You know, it can mean that you've just had chronic knee damage or you've had, like in my case, I have 10% each knee. That doesn't mean I can't walk. It just means that they can see the cartilage damage and the various damages over the years. So you are given a certain percentage, and then what happens is that you're able to go to the VA and get your medical care there. There may be supplemental costs that are going to be added on now that we have Obamacare. The reality is everybody's going to have some skin in the game. I am very torn on how I feel about this issue. I do understand as veterans that we are entitled to certain things, but I am not a veteran who advocates for an entitlement program. We have to ensure that it's a fair system and that it doesn't crush our economy. Right now, medical benefits in the Department of Defense is probably one of their highest costs of sustaining the DOD. We have not only the veterans, that the military themselves, but you have their family members and their children. It's an exorbitant amount of cost, and it has to be run effectively and efficiently. So I'm not a medical care expert, but I do know the insurance companies have caused costs to skyrocket. I know there's a lot of mismanagement. I know there's a lot of ways to make this more efficient and more effective. And if a veteran is paying for medical care per se out of pocket, if it's a minimal cost, it may be fair that they have skin in the game. When people don't have skin in the game, they can turn around and actually abuse their medical care too. You know, they can be the person who's chronically in the emergency room, chronically taking advantage. So I would have to review that a little closer before I can give a very firm or confident opinion on what is right and what is wrong.
All right, Talbert, how about you taking that?
You know, I heard Jesse talking about the crony capitalism before, and I'm not a medical cost expert at all, but I can't help but think that if we could get rid of so much of this crony capitalism and all of the misspent money and the money that's going in people's pockets, just because they know somebody in government or they have some kind of connection, that there would be a whole lot of money available to help take care of these veteran medical needs that we don't have available now, and then we wouldn't have to be worried about the question that's before us, which is, should they be paying for part of their medical care or not? And sure, okay, so they should have some skin in the game. I completely agree with that. But my goodness, there is so much waste that if we didn't have that, then we probably wouldn't be needing to have this kind of discussion at all anyway.
All right. Now, I'm going to change the subject just a little bit because we had what would probably be deemed tomorrow or even today workplace violence over at the Navy Yard over in D.C. And today there was supposed to be a scheduled Senate hearing on Stand Your Ground, or as we call it here in South Carolina, the Castle Doctrine. But, Talbert, you know, something recently happened here with our Castle Doctrine, the Stand Your Ground, with a Chief Justice Toll. And I've talked about
right.
it before, but I want you to explain it, because it's very odd that the Senate has chosen to cancel this hearing because of this shooting that was over in D.C. yesterday. And, you know, I feel sorry for those 12 people that lost their lives, that they were murdered. And the shooter
absolutely.
Was taken out as the dog he was.
Yeah, right. The shooter, and I was listening to the radio earlier today, and the advice of the DJ or the show host was not to even call him a shooter, because I'm a shooter. I go out and shoot all the time, but I'm not a killer. This guy was a killer. He was a cold-blooded, deranged killer. He was just it's really tragic. It really is. Now, the Stand Your Ground or the Castle Doctrine in South Carolina has really been under fire, and Jean Toll, you know, bless her heart, she is just, I don't know where she's coming from on this. It's really crazy. There are several cases that are being heard across South Carolina that involve Stand Your Ground, where the people who have shot and killed somebody are arguing that it was in self-defense. Some of them may be, some of them not. I don't know the details of all the cases, but there's one particular case where there was an individual who, with his partner, broke into a home, and the guy that's on trial pulled out his gun and killed the homeowner. Now, when this gets to trial, he's pleading Stand Your Ground, if you could believe it, which is completely crazy. He's saying that the homeowner pulled out a gun. He was afraid for his life, so he pulled out his gun and shot the homeowner, pleading Stand Your Ground. It's a ridiculous use of that statute. So instead of just throwing it out and saying that you can't use this, which the lower court did, then they appealed it to the Supreme Court. Gene Cole used this as an opportunity to make a ruling that now will be precedent throughout South Carolina, that if you plead Stand Your Ground defense, which according to the Castle Doctrine in South Carolina, if you successfully plead Stand Your Ground, then you don't even go to trial. You can't be brought to trial. So if you plead Stand Your Ground and the judge denies it, you cannot appeal that ruling now, according to Gene Toll, until after you have stood trial and been found guilty. Then, after all of that, you can appeal the original ruling on your Stand Your Ground pleading after all that, which is completely ridiculous. So now it's, I don't know what's going to happen now. It's a bad situation. You know, Gene Toll is up for re-election in South Carolina. The General Assembly elects our judges, and she's up for re-election. So the best thing we can do is make sure she doesn't get re-elected by the General Assembly. So that's going to take a good bit of work. But it's just a ridiculous ruling.
Well, I know that a couple of people in the State House will be working against her. I know my representative here in Beaufort County definitely will be. So it's going to be an upward fight, and it's going to be something we have to take throughout all the Tea Parties here in South Carolina and get them to contact their representatives and say, hey, listen, she's got to go. I mean,
yeah.
Because the only way we're going to overturn this is, I'm sorry?
I was just going to say, part of the problem here in South Carolina, which goes beyond just the gun issue, is that our judiciary branch of government is completely, wholly owned by, so to speak, the General Assembly. The General Assembly elects our judges. They also fund the judiciary, appropriate funds for the judges. And worse than that, before you can even be qualified as a candidate for a seat on court as a judge, you have to be screened by this 10-member Judicial Merit Selection Committee, which is staffed by members of the General Assembly. And there's three members of the General Assembly that appoint these 10. So really, those three members of the General Assembly control South Carolina's judicial branch of government in South Carolina. And so we don't have an independent judiciary in South Carolina.
Sometimes it's very, very confusing. I try to figure out how things are run here in South Carolina. You know, it's a little difficult to follow. You know, I'm more linear when I do my thinking. But we do have some callers in on the line, and we just lost Jesse. Unfortunately, her call just dropped. But let me. Thomas.
It's
good afternoon, Thomas.
Just listening, Manny.
Okay. All right. And if you want to make a comment. But, you know, we're getting left and right assaults on our gun rights, our Second Amendment rights, and it's very ironic that today, of all days, is the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. And to do something by executive order, reference right now. Did you hear anything about that, Talbert?
And I'm sorry, I am hearing about every other word that you're saying.
All right, for some reason, I don't know where you are, but you're breaking up in and out also. Did you want to try to call back in?
Yeah, let me just try to call back in and see if that clears things up. I'm sorry.
That's all right. You know, it happens. It's live radio. We don't know what's going to be on. You know, it is ironic that today, you know, we have signing of the Constitution, then President Obama says he wants to take control of gun control by executive order, basically bypassing Congress again. I think I lost my.
Well, we just can't let them. It's that simple. I mean, Jesse had commented, you know, about, you know, people keep doing this. It starts with me. I mean, people are just stupid. And this incident that is now taking place in Washington, D.C., there's a perfect example. There is no place anywhere probably on the globe with stricter gun laws, not even in the communist countries, than Washington, D.C. If this happens, it begins and ends with you and I.
What they're talking about is that here you have this incident yesterday, but they don't say that this guy was one of those played like 6 to 8 hours a day, these combat video games where you're shooting hundreds of people. And every single one of these shootings over the last several years goes back to someone that's addicted to one of these video games. You know, they don't mention the fact that he was dishonorably discharged from the Navy because of gun incidents. Now, why would he purchase a gun if he was involved in these gun incidents? I think every trial where he was convicted of a gun crime, it's a lot of questions. And here, you're going down a slippery slope. Calvert, where is it? Is Calvert back with us? This is
I'm not sure.
You are.
Well, because, you know, Annie, we're never going to stop. We're never going to stop these type of things are going to happen in life. But until the day we die, we're going to be seeing these incidents happen. It's that simple as far as from the human aspect. That shootings and all this didn't just start 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Going on, all kind, everything and anything has been going on. Things get more intense, things kind of change, maybe because people are more addicted to drugs or what have you. But these type of things you will never, ever, 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 ever under any incident stop. Here is something that's very sad, that when you are Bill Clinton signed into law that these people, while they're walking around, you know, in their respective camps, they're not allowed to carry firearms. Now, think of the Fort Hood shooting. If people there were allowed to carry firearms, people who are the best at their skilled trade, a lot of what the damage that would have happened probably could have been avoided. Same thing as yesterday. But once again, government causes problems. They virtually solve nothing. Never under any circumstances, usually never, do they help anything or make anything better. They always confuse it. So that's why I say it begins and ends with me.
Well, you know, the gun laws really only disarm the victim, just like you said, in Fort Hood yesterday. If those soldiers and the sailors and even the civilian contractors had been allowed to carry to arm themselves, to defend themselves against these crazy people, you might have had one dead, maybe two, right? The first one, the killer shot, and then the killer himself would have been killed. And that would have been the end of it. You wouldn't have had a dozen people killed or more. And we've just got to make sure that good people are armed, that we don't have the gun control laws to simply disarm the victims.
All right, I have to apologize. I ended up switching headsets here because I was hearing people saying that I was breaking up. I apologize for that. But it's true.
I'm hearing you great now.
D.C. has some of the strictest gun laws ever, and yet they have the highest gun rate. Same thing with Chicago. Now, here you've got the Navy Yard, thanks to the Democrats, you're not allowed to carry. And again, had there been someone with a legal, gun carry permit, this would never have probably even gotten past person number one. As I understand it, this guy had a shotgun, which is not accurate, but it's going to hit something and cause a lot of damage. There was a lot of rumors about other weapons, there, but I think one news report had it as an AR-15 shotgun.
Anyone
that knows anything about an AR-15 knows it does not come shotgun. You're talking about two completely different firearms. One's a rifle and one's a shotgun, and the two do not marry.
Well, and the fact of the matter is we hear different reports of what kind of guns they are, and we won't know, as always, early we like to speculate, and people are quick to judgment. Here's the bottom line, is what we had said earlier. And clearly, Annie, this wasn't a Democrat thing. This was Bill Clinton, because they had a Republican House and Senate at the time. But George Bush could have repealed that. So could President Obama, but they did not. And this once again, part of the problem is government. And, I mean, we allow them to get away with that. The Constitution clearly states what government can and cannot do. They report to you and I and our guests and our listeners and the taxpayers of this country. And you know what? We just continue and continue the apathy of the people, the apathy of the people. I mean, another example is that how many times do these politicians talk down to us? Lord have mercy.
Every single time. I mean,
yeah,
I saw a county council meeting last night when I stood up to speak. I saw the smirks on some of their faces, and it's like, well, she can blow as much hot air as she wants up our skirts, but we're just going to do whatever we feel like. And my response was, when I looked at them, and I says, remember, 2014, four of you are up for re-election, and we will not forget, and we're not. Because as soon as I left the room, we were talking, all right, who can we get for this seat? Who can we get for that seat? We're already gearing up to turn around and take these seats back. And I think that, Talbot, this is what we have to do, not just, of course, the state of South Carolina, but the entire nation. And
absolutely. At the local level, at the state level, and at the national level, until we stop treating our politicians like celebrities, until we stop making excuses for our favorite politician that we voted for or we helped get elected, until we stop making excuses for them and hold them accountable for every single vote that they cast wrong, every single bill that they support that's wrong, and shout it from the rooftop every time they do something wrong, share it with our friends, and let them know, you know what, yeah, I voted for this guy, I helped him get elected, but he is not doing what he's supposed to do, and we're going to replace him this time around. Until we do that and do it consistently, we're going to keep having these same problems over and over again.
Yeah, and one thing that really gets me nuts is that when you do challenge these politicians on their policies and everything else, they end up talking to you and lecturing you as if you're like a little 5-year-old school child. And you look at them like, I'm a full-grown adult. I probably have, you know, grandkids older than your kids. So why are you talking down to me?
Yeah,
I'm going to tell you guys something. I'm going to share with you something, and you guys are going to think I'm lying. But it's the truth. May lightning strike me down. I argued over the Michigan had a tough vote, but they decided by one vote. It was a tie in our state Senate, so the lieutenant governor broke the tie that we were going to join the Medicaid expansion. Sorry, I had to go buy a truck. But anyway, so the individual I had this heated conversation with said to me, you are a fiscal conservative, correct? I said, yeah. He says, well, this is really a fiscal conservative policy. I thought to myself, you know what? If I had a gun, I'd either shoot him or shoot myself, because I have never in my life whatsoever tried to tell me that this is a conservative issue. I mean, these people, I have to know what drugs they're taking, because I got to get some. It just, these people are hallucinating beyond any mankind.
All right, now, Talbot, you've got yourself involved in a couple of different groups here. You've got the Palmetto Liberty Pack, and now you also have the Palmetto Gun Rights, and you put out a Palmetto Policy Forum. Try to say that 3 times fast. I'm not doing too well on this one.
Right, so there's Palmetto Gun Rights, which I help out with their legislative work. Denise Snelling is the chairman. She's doing a really great job. The organization is about a year and a half old, and we've already had pretty good success in the state house with stopping the bad legislation, and we're on the cusp of getting restaurant carry passed, and we're working on constitutional carry as well. And then there's also Palmetto Liberty, which I started a couple of years ago as a direct electioneering group. We call it a PAC, but under South Carolina law, it's actually a non-candidate committee, but we're allowed to do direct electioneering work. So I formed that so that I can get directly involved in elections and trying to throw the bad guys out and help the good guys in. And then the third organization is Campaign for Liberty, which I am the state coordinator, and that's a 501c4 nonprofit. And it's for limited government, fiscal responsibility, getting the government out of our lives, that kind of thing.
All right. Now, are you involved at all with the 10th Amendment Center?
No, I am not. They're doing some good work. and but I'm not involved with what they're doing directly. Now, I support, you know, the type of work that they're doing with the states resisting the federal government and nullifying laws which are unconstitutional. I support that completely, but I am not directly involved with it.
Yeah, because when I was thumbing through doing the research for today, I came across, and I couldn't see where everything followed through, because I know earlier this year our state house nullified Obamacare, 65-39, but I don't see where it went to the Senate. And then on the opposite side, again earlier this year, the Senate approved the NDAA nullification, 25-15, but I don't see where it went to the House. So they're doing these things, but they're being hung up.
Right. So the House passed what they call nullification. What they ended up passing really wasn't much of a nullification in the end, but it's stuck in the Senate, and it is near the top of the calendar when they reconvene in January. They'll be taking that up. And then the NDAA nullification did pass the Senate, but it is stuck in the House and is not moving over there. So we've got to put some pressure on the House to get that moving.
All right. Well, at least now I know where I can blast my membership here and say, hey, let's get something done here. Now, you were talking about a constitutional carry. You know, exactly what is that?
Okay. So in South Carolina right now, if you want to carry a weapon, first of all, you cannot carry openly, period, at any time unless you're going hunting. When you're hunting, you can carry open. Or unless you're a law enforcement officer, you can carry open. And by open, that means where people can see it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to carry, then you have to go ask permission from the government. You have to be fingerprinted. You have to be trained by a licensed trainer. You have to pass a test. You have to pay the trainer. You have to pay SLED to run a background check. After all of that is done, then you get to wait 90 days, and then you get a license carry. And then there's very specific places where you can and cannot carry a gun in South Carolina. So what constitutional carry would do is would still allow you to get a license to carry if you wanted to. And that's important because a lot of states, if you want to go carry in another state besides South Carolina, they won't allow you to carry unless you have a South Carolina license to carry. So constitutional carry will allow the licensing process to remain. It simply won't be required to have a license to carry in South Carolina. So if you legally can own a weapon in South Carolina, if constitutional carry passes, then you'll be able to carry that weapon in South Carolina without going through all the steps, jumping through the hoops, and being fingerprinted and treated like a common criminal before you can carry a weapon in South Carolina.
Yeah, because in South Carolina, as I try to remember, because I got my permit, more than a decade ago, as I remember it, that you can own a weapon, you can have it in your vehicle, either in a glove box or something like that. It cannot be exposed, but you don't need a carry permit. Whereas if you want to take that weapon now and carry it concealed, you would then have to then go the additional step to get the permit. And
exactly right. So you can own a weapon in South Carolina. You don't have to be licensed or get a license to own a weapon. You can have it in your house or on your property in any way you want. Carry it openly on your property. The minute you step off of your property, then you either have to have it in your glove box, in the trunk, or in your console, in your car, or you've got to have a license to carry it any other way. And then it has to be concealed. In South Carolina, if your weapon becomes unconcealed, you know, if you've got it under your shirt, and for some reason your shirt rises up and the policeman sees your weapon, then you're immediately fined, and you can spend time in jail, which is ridiculous. South Carolina's, I think it's only four or six, I can't remember, states that completely ban open carry of a weapon, which you think South Carolina being a good southern state, you know, being weapons friendly, which is not as weapons friendly as a lot of people think, that you'd be able to carry openly, but South Carolina, complete ban on open carry.
Yeah, and now I was catching something on a news article, and this was out in Missouri. A group of kids were traveling through Missouri, and they stopped at a Walmart. They had some sort of these, it looked like a little deli cafeteria inside Walmart, and they were getting food. And these girls had an open carry. Now, Missouri has open carry. And they put up this YouTube video, and I think it might have gone up on either Breitbart or The Blaze, I forget which. And they got stopped by, you know, police officers, and one of them had an assault rifle. And they're confronting these people that have a legal right for an open carry, demanding identification. And their kids are asking, you know, why are you stopping us? Did we do something? But what I didn't know is that Missouri has this little fine print in the law that if someone sees you with an open carry and they, for some reason, are upset or felt threatened, they can call the police. And if they call the police, then the police can come over and cite the person because you upset someone else.
Yeah, you know, I heard something very similar to that in another state where there was a paraplegic man who had a weapon on his side for self-defense, which I'm not sure how he could use it, right, if you're paraplegic. But because other people around him were frightened because they saw his weapon and called the police, then he was cited for disturbing the peace. He wasn't doing anything, but because people were frightened because they saw his weapon, which he was legally carrying, he got cited for disturbing the peace. So, yeah, the law enforcement now is trying to get around all of the weapons laws any way that they can, those who are against open carry or any kind of carry, to use the law in various different ways to try to harass and make it difficult for good, law-abiding citizens who just want to carry for self-defense. Make it very difficult for us to defend ourselves.
It is true. And being a female, you know, it's a little bit more difficult for us to carry concealed than it is for a man. And if you say, oh, sure, just put it in your purse, well, what happens if someone snatches your purse?
Right. You know, and my advice to all the women out there who carry in their purse, don't, for that very reason. The second reason is because it's very difficult. If you need it in a hurry, how long does it take you to get into your purse, get your weapon, get it pulled out, and get it on target? Very long time. And I realize sometimes that's the only way you can carry. And, yeah, the concealed weapons law is very unfair to females.
Yeah, your options are very, very limited. And trust me, I've had a firearm since 86, and it's always very interesting in trying to find places to conceal it. Not easy.
Sure. And, you know, if you want to go out for a morning run, where are you going to put it and conceal it? You know, there's not really many places to carry a concealed weapon when you're wearing shorts, a T-shirt, or a tank top, or whatever. So the concealed weapon law, while it works good for many situations, is not adequate for real self-defense in South Carolina.
No, it isn't. Now, what projects are you working on? I know you've got the Palmetto Gun Rights, and you're trying to educate people about this Castle Doctrine with the Justice Toll. What else are you up on?
So with Palmetto Liberty and with the Campaign for Liberty, we're doing a lot of work in partnership with the South Carolina Policy Council. Ashley Landis is the president of that organization, and they are doing a great job with researching and defining what the barriers are to real freedom in South Carolina. So what they've done this research, and they've published some work that there's 8 items, and I won't be able to cite all 8 items to you, that need to be accomplished to make or to put South Carolina on the path, really, to being the freest state in the country. And so that's our goal, is to make South Carolina the freest state in the country. One of those is, we just mentioned Jean Toll and the non-independent judiciary that we have. So one of the items on that list is to make our judiciary branch of government completely independent of the legislature, in that we would follow the federal model. You know, if it was good enough for Madison and the founders, then it's probably a pretty good model. It's not perfect, and there probably is no perfect model, but it's good in that the executive, so in the federal government, the executive is the president, appoints the judges with advice and consent of the Senate. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, that's not working out too good for the Supreme Court. But imagine if the legislature had complete control over who goes to the Supreme Court. And do you think the Supreme Court then would ever rule against the Congress, that laws that Congress made would be unconstitutional or something like that? So that's the situation we have in South Carolina. And so following that federal model, although not perfect, like I said, I don't think there's any perfect model for appointing judges, but a lot better than having one branch of government completely dependent on another branch of government. And then there's income source disclosure. My goodness, in South Carolina, we have, I would say, we have more corruption than probably any other state in the country, including Louisiana, including Chicago. The problem is most of the corruption in South Carolina is completely legal. They get away with lots of lining their own pockets with the taxpayers' money that doesn't break laws in South Carolina, because they make the laws, they appoint the judges to judge the laws, and so they get to do a lot of what in other countries or other states would be completely illegal. So those are really two big things that we're working on.
Well, I was thumbing through some of the legislation that was pending, and, man, there is a lot out there for the state of South Carolina. I noticed numerous attempts at term limits.
Right, yep.
And
they talk about that a good bit.
But they don't do anything about it.
No, they don't. And I have to tell you, honestly, I am not sure that I would be completely for term limits. And here's why. When you've got somebody who is good, you want to keep them in there, right? When
mm-hmm.
you've got somebody who is bad, then you want to get them out. Having term limits really is just a Band-Aid on the real problem, which was mentioned earlier, and that is just voter apathy. You know, if you've got a bad guy in there and the voters don't care about it and he gets term limited out, then you're just going to get another bad guy in there replacing him. So the real solution is for the voters to wake up and pay attention and make sure that we watch what's going on, make sure that we limit the power that our General Assembly has, because, you know, if they don't have the power that they do now, then they're not going to be a lot of people wanting to get in there to abuse the power, because there's no power to abuse. So I'm not real sure that I think term limits is going to be a real solution to the problems that we have.
Right, and one other thing I noticed also is that they want members of the House and Senate in the State House to reveal lobbying efforts. I'm trying to remember how that was worded. Any connections with lobbyists, which I think is a good thing. I mean, you know, you do need lobbyists to an extent, but to the amount that it's gotten corrupted and how much money is going back and forth is frightening.
Right. So complete income source disclosure. You know, the federal government requires it. If you want to run for office, then you have to file paperwork that specifies all your sources of income. Now, I'm not sure the federal government requires you to specify the amount or not. I don't think the amount is so important as the source, because if you know who is paying these people, then you start to see why they're voting the way they're voting. You end up with people like Gilda Cobb Hunter, who is a representative from Orangeburg, who had a line item put in the budget for $200,000, I think it was $200,000, from the state budget to be given to a charity. Well, it so happens that it's the charity that she serves as the executive director for. That charity pays her $84,000 a year. So she literally, one step removed, is taking money out of the state budget, putting it into her pocket. Now, without income source disclosure, we'd never know that. And the only reason we know it now is because we've got some really good investigative reporters at the NERV, which is an online reporting group that went and discovered this and reported on it and called her up. She happened to have been on vacation in Hawaii, asked her about it. She said, well, you know, I just don't think there's anything wrong with that. She got back to the state, and the General Assembly went back in session. Governor Haley vetoed that line item, and there was a good public uproar about her getting paid that $84,000 by this charity that she was taking $200,000 out of the budget for. And luckily the House supported the veto, and she didn't get that. And then you end up with people like Hugh Leatherman, who runs a concrete company that gets millions and millions and millions of dollars from state construction contracts. You know, these guys are literally lining their pockets with taxpayers' money, and they're doing it largely because we don't know who's paying them, so we can't hold them accountable for these things they're doing.
Well, Talbert, we're down to our last 5 minutes. And this show is going fast. I'm so sorry that Jesse dropped off. Looks like a couple of people that were calling in have been having problems with their connections. Matter of fact, I lost my co-host.
Oh, goodness. Well, that has been great. I really have enjoyed the show, and it does go by fast, doesn't it?
It does. It does go by fast. And I welcome you back anytime. And I'm going to be contacting your office to get you to come down here to Beaufort County to address our tea party here. We're just starting up on monthly meetings. And I got my co-host back. Cool Mike, you're back here on the air live. You want one last question before we let Talbert go?
What can we do, do you think, what can we do to just change the tide, to just tidal wave all the bullshit? I mean, it's just like, what can we do to get the momentum on our side and the ball rolling downhill?
Well, I'll tell you my thoughts, and again, I'm going to direct it to South Carolina, but I think the same thing applies across the country. We have got to, as an electorate, as voters, be awake and aware, holding our politicians accountable for every single thing they do. It doesn't matter whether it's our favorite politician or whether it's the politician that we just hate to see every day. Anything that they do that is counter to freedom and liberty and opposes, the Constitution, that opposes free market principles, that opposes the right to self-defense, we have got to call them out on it. We have got to make their lives utterly miserable to be them as long as they're not representing us and doing the things that they're supposed to do. And we've got to do it. We've got to talk to our neighbors so that they're doing it. And we've got to be organized, especially in South Carolina. We've got to be organized and working together. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there needs to be like one, overlord entity over all the grassroots of South Carolina. That's not what we need to do. But we've got to communicate and to talk to each other and work together and be organized and focused on the things that really matter, the things that are keeping us from having the freest state in America. And it, in South Carolina at least, is the structure of government, it's the income disclosure, it's the equal and opposing branches of government. And people think we have this great republic in South Carolina, this little R Republican form of government. I'm telling you, South Carolina is one of the worst, most corrupt states. We have a legislative tyranny. I could go on, and I know we're out of time and I won't. But people have got to be focused, organized, and active in holding our politicians accountable. And until we do that, we can fight all these periphery issues that we want to, and nothing's going to change until we get down to the very core heart of the matter, which is limiting the power and authority of government so that there's nothing there to even abuse. Until we do that, we're really hopelessly lost.
Amen to that. We're down to our last 2 minutes. And Talbert, thank you so much. It has been very, very interesting. And again, like I said, I will be contacting you as soon as we get our meetings going up, which will be starting next month. I'm just got to solidify the date and time.
I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful.
Okay, Talbert Black, thank you so very much. And God bless. Wow. Very great guest. I mean, both of them were great, Mike. And we've got excellent guests coming
up.
Yeah, we've got former CIA operative Charles Faddis, who has a new book out called CAFA. He'll be in on Friday. And then we have penciled in on next Tuesday Congressman Mark Sanford. I'm also looking to see if I can get author Kevin Shipp in. He's got a new book out on the CIA that I've been reading and I'm fascinated with. And here we go. On the 27th, just before I disappear, we've got a Senate candidate from Georgia, Derek Grayson, and he's going to be joining us. He's a reverend and a Senate candidate, and it's going to be absolutely fantastic. So,
amen to that.
We'll be back on Friday, same bat time, same bat station. So I want to thank everyone for joining us. And for those that called in, Thomas and Stu from New Mexico, and those that were in the chat room, thank you all. See you back here on Friday. Good night and God bless.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up and try. trouble.
You've
face.
Been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.